in what we're calling a trek to Golgotha. We've been trying to detect what it was that caused Jesus' fellow countrymen to so hate him that they would reject him and orchestrate his death by crucifixion. That's what we've been attempting to do in the last, 6 or 8 weeks. And the purpose of it is to figure out what it was that he felt so strongly about that he simply would not back down, even at the cost of his life. And we noticed the friction that he caused about their Sabbath observances, and he objected to what they were doing because what they were doing was oppressive to people. And we then saw the conflict that arose over their ceremonial washings. And the reason why he was in such conflict with them is because what they were doing on the outside had no bearing to what they were on the inside or to what they were trying to become on the inside. Their external purity was not related to any internal purity. It was a mask to cover up their internal debauchery and their internal uncleanness. And then we saw their conflict that he had with them over sin and sinners. The disagreement that he had with their definition of sin, that it does not come from external contamination. It comes from internal alienation from God. And that sinners are not to be hated, they're to be loved. And Jesus became a friend of sinners, where the Pharisees became people who stood back and wouldn't dare touch them or be around them. Now, in all of this, a very personal thing enters into it. In all of these conflicts, and if you'll notice this, in all of these conflicts, somebody got embarrassed. Somebody became humiliated. And the fat was in the fire. Guess who got embarrassed in all of these conflicts? And you could just name them one after another. Somebody became red-faced and humiliated. Who was it? The religious leaders, the Pharisees. They became extremely embarrassed. And the Sadducees. But they, and you just simply do not embarrass, you do not humiliate religious leaders in front of their followers without getting in bad, bad trouble. Jesus did it repeatedly. He did not humiliate anyone. But because of the attitude of heart of his opponents, his exposing them humiliated them. It could have humbled them. You understand? What he did to them could have humbled them. But it didn't humble them because their hearts were not right. And instead of humbling them, it humiliated them. But that's depending upon the person. It did not depend upon what Jesus did. Jesus did not humiliate people, but they were humiliated. And you just don't do that without getting in trouble. In the class last hour, we set the stage for this hour. The themes converge. In the last hour, we were talking about the backbone of the Bible. In this hour, we're going to be talking about how that backbone began to protrude and began to rub the Jewish leaders raw. God's unchangeable purpose, and we need to understand this, God's unchangeable purpose is that every human being on the face of the earth might come to know Him. Just that simple. That's his unchangeable purpose. That all people of all nations might come to be known by Him and might be included in His family. Now, strangely enough, the Jews were in favor of this. The Jews wanted this to be. But guess who they wanted to be the standard by which everyone else was judged? They wanted to be in the center of the picture. They wanted to be the standard by which everyone else was going to be judged as to whether or not they were God's children or not. In fact, they were very anxious about it. They were very evangelistic about it. They were very militant about it. Jesus said on one occasion, I think it's in Matthew 23, He said, you compass, one translation says, you compass land and sea that you might make one single convert, one single proselyte. They were anxious to make proselytes. But he said, when you've made him that, you make him twofold more a son of hell than yourselves. Pretty strong language. But I'm just simply saying, they were in favor of it, provided that everybody else came to look just like them and came to be Jewish people. They wanted those outsiders. They wanted those people of other nations to come to bow down before the God of Israel, to be circumcised, to keep the law, to keep the kosher traditions and all. They wanted that. But they wanted it to be sure that they were the ones that were the standard by which it was judged. And when this Jesus came in and turned the tables on them, and not only did they not be the center of the picture, the question was whether they were even going to be in the picture. Because Jesus began to say some things and do some things that not only took them out of the center of the picture, he began to imply that they were going to be taken out of the picture. Look, if you would. Jesus served unmistakable notice that the Jewish nation was no longer to be the center. And depending upon their response to him, they may no longer even be in the picture. Jesus began his ministry among Jews. He himself said, I'm sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That was because he had to start somewhere. He couldn't start with the whole world. He had to start like God started with Abraham. He started with a small group of people. He started with the Jewish nation themselves, and he made that as his beginning. But it was only his beginning. He began his ministry, though, interestingly enough, among Jews, but it was among Jews who were in Gentile cities. Jesus began his ministry where? Where do you think he actually began his personal ministry? He began it in Capernaum. It's the city of Nahum. Dates back thousands of years. It's still there. It's on the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus began his ministry there. One of the first things that he did, now that's important because of the fact it was in a city that was strongly influenced by Greek culture. It was strongly influenced by non-Jewish customs. The Jews who lived there, in a sense, became contaminated. I'll show you what I mean in just a minute. But one of the first things that he did, turn to Matthew, if you will, please, with me in the 8th chapter. Matthew, the 8th chapter. A very unusual and beautiful thing happens. Matthew 8 and beginning in verse 5. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him. Now, this man was a Roman. He wasn't a Jew, he was a Roman. A centurion came to him and asked for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. Jesus said to him, I will go and heal him. Now, one of the other accounts said that some of the friends of this man came to him and said, this man is worthy for you to do this. He even built our synagogue for us, so he is worthy. He has befriended us. He's worthy for us to befriend him. Would you go and heal him? Jesus said, yes. But the man said, Lord, I don't deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. I say to that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. So he said, it's not necessary for you to come into my house. Just say the word. It'll be done. My goodness. It doesn't often say that Jesus was astonished. It doesn't, but sometimes, this is one of the times when Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. I say to you that many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the subjects of the kingdom, who are the subjects of the kingdom? The Jewish people. The subjects of the kingdom, what's going to happen to them? They'll be thrown outside the picture. They're going to be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. You see this strange incident that took place there? He's down there in the city of Capernaum with Jewish people following him in this Gentile-infested city, this Greek-influenced city. And here came this Roman soldier and said, sir, my servant is dying. Would you come heal him? Would you heal him? And the man, Jesus said, yes. And he said, I'll go with you. And he said, well, that's not necessary. Just say the word.
And then Jesus complimented this man and said, I've never seen such faith, not even in Israel. And he said, furthermore, people from the east and the west, and I think Luke adds north and south, they're going to come and sit down at the table with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and the subjects of the kingdom are going to be kicked out into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, Matthew records no furor having been created by this, neither does Luke. It does not say that the Jews gasped and heard him then give preference to this non-Jew and say, what are you talking about, and get angry. Now, why is that? Well, I don't know. Maybe they just simply did not record the furor that it caused. But are you aware of how strong this statement is? That the subjects of the kingdom, the Jewish nation, are going to be cast out of the kingdom, and the kingdom is going to be given to somebody else, and they're going to be outside looking in, where for 1400 years they've been on the inside looking out? Do you realize how strong that is? And yet there's not anything said that indicates any kind of an adverse reaction. It may very well be because this was in a Gentile-infested city where the influence of the culture was such that it had knocked the rough edges off of these Jewish people. And so it didn't cause such a stir. Now, if you don't believe that happens, go outside the Bible Belt if you're living in the Bible Belt. Send your children outside the Bible Belt. Send them overseas. Send them to South America. Send them down to Brazil and let them spend 6 months or a year in Brazil. And then when they come home, ask them some of the what you consider the mundane questions about the church and about our positions on things, and see if they don't look at you like you're living on another planet. Well, what happened? They got down there where the influence was such that they realized a whole other perspective is called upon, is required. And by the way, it may not be just like you thought it was. Now, let me show you what happened later. Later on, shortly after this, Jesus went to Nazareth. Now, Capernaum isn't all that far from Nazareth, but in a sense, it's on another planet. Nazareth is a little town, a little village. Capernaum was a city. Capernaum was a trade route. Nazareth was this little country town. The synagogue was made up of country people. What difference does that make between being in a city influenced by Greek culture, cosmopolitan in its makeup, in contrast to a little town called Nazareth that was almost so insignificant as to not even be on the map, back away from the regular routes and all? What difference does it make? You want to know the difference? Go from a city church in, say, in Houston or Dallas. Go from those cities. Go to a little church out at where? Where? Allison. Alice. Go to Alice. Go to Mule Shoe. And watch the difference. Or just, if you really want to see something vivid, send me to a church in Dallas and let me preach there. And then call and get a report. Send me to preach the same sermon in Mule Shoe. And then send for my corpse. What's the difference? Same message. The difference is, by the way, and I don't know a thing about Mule Shoe, I just remember the name, or Alice, or wherever, being in a little small town where there's very little contact with the outside world, traditions don't die easily. And people being in a traditional mindset fare a whole lot better and a whole lot more undisturbed in a small little country church than they do in a big city metropolitan where you have such a cosmopolitan influence. That's, I think, what happened here. Let me tell you what happened. Jesus went back just shortly after he had that stay in Capernaum. It says he went back to Nazareth, his hometown. This is in Luke, the 4th chapter. Turn if you want to look at this. This is a beauty. He went, verse 16. He went to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day. You know the story well. In fact, let me just tell it. You turn to it and I'll tell it. You follow me and check me out. He went back to Nazareth where he'd been brought up, his hometown. He had already begun his ministry in Capernaum. We know that from something that he says later on down in the story. But he went there and he was there over the weekend. And being there over the weekend, where he stayed, I don't know, he may have stayed with his mother, I guess. But that wasn't where his home was. He had already moved his home to Capernaum. He went back home to visit, stayed there over the weekend. Saturday morning, he got up and went to the synagogue, and they recognized him, and they welcomed him, and they were so glad to see him. And they gave him a scroll and said, "Jesus, would you mind reading this morning?" And he said, "All right." So he went and sat down, and when the time came to read out of the Old Testament scriptures, which is all they had, they gave him this scroll. He had opened it up, and he found this reading out of Isaiah. And this was the reading: "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." That's what he read. If you want to get a kick, if you want to get an additional shock, go get your Bibles, go home. Don't do it now, because you'll be gasping all over. Go get your Bibles when you get home and read Isaiah chapter 61, verses 1 and 2, and read the whole of the second verse. Jesus didn't read the whole of the second verse. When you get home, look it up and you'll see why he didn't read all of verse 2. Okay? But he read it, and there was something about it. He was a great reader. John, I love to hear you read. I love to hear you read the scriptures. And it just thrills me to hear you read those great, powerful scriptures. You do such a good job. Jesus did a great job as he stood and read that. He gave it back to the attendant, the usher, and he sat down. And it says, the eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fixed upon him. Everybody was watching him. Everybody, you could have cut the silence with a knife. And Jesus sat down and everybody was staring at him to see what was going to happen next. And he said, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Well, that's enough to have blown the thing out of the water. How dare this unknown... And they said, isn't this Joseph's son? Isn't this Mary's son? My goodness, this is Joseph's son. Yeah, but what it says, they were all amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. I think perhaps it escaped them that he said, "This has been fulfilled in your hearing today." That's terribly egocentric, if you want to look at it in a way. It's terribly egotistical to think that in him, the words of Isaiah 61 were going to be fulfilled that day, that the Spirit of the Lord was upon him, and that he had come to do all these great things. It says they were amazed at the gracious words. And you want to say to Jesus, "Jesus, they just complimented you. Let it alone. Just say thank you, or I'm thankful, or I'm glad to be back home," whatever. You could have said something. He could have said anything other than what he said. And when they said, "Jesus, that was so beautiful, we thank you," he could have just said thank you. But he said, "No doubt you're going to say to me, 'Physician, heal yourself. Do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum.'" You see, he had already been working in Capernaum. But that was they were Yankees. That's a good way of expressing it. They were Yankees. "Do here in the South what you did up above the Mason-Dixon line." He said, "No doubt you're going to say to me, 'Physician, heal yourself. Do here what you've done in Capernaum.'" He didn't have to say that. He did not have to bring that up. They didn't bring it up. He brought it up. Well, what was his point? Listen to what he says. It was an introduction to what he's saying next. "I tell you the truth." And that was his buzzword. Jesus had some buzzwords. This was really the only buzzword he had. And last Sunday we talked about saying things in a way that gets people's attention, and we won't curse or anything. Well, Jesus had a buzzword. Do you know what his buzzword was? His expression. "Verily, verily, I say to you." In other words, this was his way of grabbing your attention. "I'm telling you the truth. You better listen to me." And here's what he said. "I tell you the truth. No prophet is accepted in his hometown." Well, they just got through accepting him, yeah, but it wasn't long.
I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut up for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. What on earth are you talking about? He was simply saying here that God bypassed the Jewish people in order to show a kindness to a Sidonian. There's no record of anything that's said here. I don't think anyone said anything. I think they were aghast. I think they said, "Did I hear you say what I thought I heard you say?" And then he said, furthermore, there were a lot of lepers in the time of Elisha, and yet Elisha was not sent to any of them except to whom? Naaman, who was a what? I don't want to hear it. A what? A Syrian. Have mercy. You're talking about Sidonians and Syrians and that God bypassed the Jewish people in order to show mercy to Sidonians and to Syrians? Jesus said, I'll tell you the truth. That is precisely what he did. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up and drove him out of the town. They took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him down the cliff. He nearly got killed. What's the difference? I think it took place in a small local synagogue in a small rural town where the tradition was such that they could not get over what they'd been raised in. And what they'd been raised in was the very thing Jesus locked horns with, and he would not let it go. And he brought up the subject and he insisted that they solve it, and they nearly killed him. And he almost lost his life prematurely. He had it planned for about 3 years down the road. They nearly killed him. And he just, I don't know how he did it, but he just simply stared them down and walked through the midst of them as though to say, I just dare you to lay a hand on me. And it just says they parted and they let him go. Well, then not only those actions, but there were other actions. And some of the things, his honoring of Gentile people, of non-Jewish people, in John the 4th chapter is one of the most lengthy records of it. You remember when he went from Judea up to Galilee and it said he had to go through Samaria? He didn't have to go through Samaria. No, the Jews of that day who went from Galilee, from Judea to Galilee, didn't go through Samaria. You know what they did? They forded the Jordan and went over into Perea and then came north and bypassed Samaria and then came back across the Jordan. That's what they would do to keep from going through Samaria. The Samaritan dogs would contaminate them. The Samaritan soil. You couldn't buy food. You couldn't get anything to drink. Nothing could be touched in Samaria because they were foreigners. They were Yankees. You couldn't touch them. It said he had to go through Samaria. No, he didn't. But he did. He was morally compelled to go through Samaria. And when he got there, it was about lunchtime. He sat down on the well, and a woman came. You know the story. The disciples went into town to get something to eat. While they were going to buy food, this Samaritan woman came. A Samaritan and a divorcee. She had had 5 husbands and she was now shacked up with a man that was not even her husband. She was living in adultery and she came to draw water. Have mercy. And Jesus did. He said, would you give me a drink of water? Which meant that he was going to drink out of her cup, or at least out of her bucket. He said, would you give me a drink of water? And she turned and looked at him and she said, how in the world do you as a Jew ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? And then he said, lady, if you knew who it was that was asking you for it, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. She said, sir, the well is deep. How are you going to draw the water? And Jesus said, the water that I give you, you drink it, you'll never thirst again. This water you'll thirst again, but the water that I give you, you'll never thirst again. And then he said, go call your husband. And she said, oh, I don't have a husband. And he said, you're right. You're right, you don't. You've had 5. And the man you're living with now isn't even your husband. You said this right. I wonder what she must have felt. What on earth she must have thought as this man tore away everything that she had. It completely undressed her. And she stood there before this man, emotionally stripped. And she said, sir, I perceive you're a prophet. You know the story. We could go on into the story, but we don't have time. But here's the point. Jesus, when he went into this situation and he sat on the well, asked for water, he stepped over this chasm of racial separation, the chasm of gender separation. He stepped over all these social things. He began to engage in social taboos, to even talk with a woman, to ask her for a drink out of her own gourd whenever, you know, you just didn't do that. John says that Jews didn't drink out of the same vessels that Samaritans did. And all of this was taking place, but then there's more to that than this. Whenever she heard him say, "I that speak to you am the Christ," she ran back into the city. She was breathless when she got into Main Street. She said, "Come quick, come quick. There's a man out there at the well that told me everything that I ever did. Come, could this be the Christ?" And so here came all these people out to watch and to see who this man was. And whenever they heard him, they said, "Would you come and stay with us? Come and visit us." And Jesus said, "All right." And he went there and stayed 2 days. Stayed 2 days among these people that were considered dogs and unclean. Now this means several things. It means that he ate with them. It means that he drank out of their vessels. It means perhaps that he slept in their beds. If they provided him hospitality, they didn't make him sleep out in the street if they had invited him to come to their homes. He slept in their beds, ate their food, drank out of their vessels. If you'll pardon me, he went to the toilet and their toilets. You don't think he waited 2 days until he could get out of there, do you? The man was a man. He was a human being. He used their restrooms if they had restrooms. Sure he did. Now you say, that makes him too common. Hey, this man was a Jewish man born 1900 years after Abraham, 2000 years ago from us. He lived and breathed. He was just like you and me, except he was God among us, pitching his tent among us. And he ate and he sweat and he smelled and he had hair and he had to shave. All the whole gamut. That was Jesus of Nazareth. And I'm thankful to God that he came and knew everything I've experienced. And that may have offended you. And you may think, "Well, wait till we get to you." Don't let it offend you. I'm trying to make this man was one of us. How on earth did he come to do what he did? How did he do it? Well, the stories that he told, the deeds that he did, the way he complimented strangers, his stories and his teachings just added fuel to the fire. You remember the story of the Good Samaritan? Oh, boy. You know the story. When the man who wanted to justify himself, one of the rulers of the synagogue, one of the rulers of the Pharisees, he said, "But who is my neighbor?" And as though Jesus said, "I'm glad you asked that. There was a man once making his way down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, and they beat him and nearly killed him, left him half dead, stripped him. And a priest came by and passed by on the other side. And a Levite came by and he passed by on the other side." And then he said, "But then a Samaritan." Of all the things. He didn't have to use a Samaritan as an example, but he did. He held this Samaritan up and said, "A Samaritan came by and was moved with compassion. And he saw the man and went to him and knelt down. And he put oil and wine on his sores, and he bound him up, and he picked him up and put him on his own donkey, and he took him into the inn and gave him to the innkeeper and took care of him all that night. And the next day he told the innkeeper, 'Now you take care of him. If he needs anything else, I'll pay you when I get back.'" Then Jesus said, and here was this religious leader, now, one of those embarrassing situations, he said, "Which of these three men proved neighbor to this man?" And the man said, "Well, I suppose the one that showed him kindness." And then Jesus said, "You go and do like that Samaritan did." Embarrassing? You bet it was embarrassing. You bet. But then after that, something else happened. Listen. His stories. There's a story that he tells. It's in Luke, the 10th chapter, verses 30. No, you Luke them in Mark, the 12th chapter, verses 1 through 12. And I've got to tell you this because otherwise you won't get the point. Mark, the 12th chapter. Jesus, now here you'll have to understand the whole week that precedes it. And we'll not have time to go into it in detail. Sunday was, let's just kind of retrace it. What happened on Sunday that was so significant? The last week of his life. What did he do? On the last week of his life, the Sunday was occupied with what? One major event. His triumphal entry. This was a great, it was a great parade, a great celebration. It upset the whole city. The whole city was in an uproar. And you can see that one of the accounts says that the rulers were standing there and they're just saying, look at it, look, the whole world is going after him. If we don't do something about him, the Romans are going to come. And I went through this in my mind and I've said it before. I said, as sure as I'm standing here, I'm going to save the Russians. The Romans. They said the Romans are going to come and they're going to take away our place and our city. That was on Sunday. He got off the donkey, walked into the temple area, and was walking around and seeing what was there and looking at all the merchants that were in the court of the Gentiles. That's where they were doing all this selling, in the court of the Gentiles now. The Jews had taken it over and were selling all this stuff in the court. And Jesus then took a whip and shouting, you know, he did not go in there with a whip, driving them out, saying, I wish you wouldn't make my Father's house a house of merchandise. He said, my Father's house is supposed to be a place of prayer for all the nations. All the nations. But you've made it a den of thieves. That only infuriated them even more because it threatened their pocketbook. And he drove out the money changers, drove out the merchants and all. That was on Tuesday. That was on Monday. Then on Tuesday, an argument ensued that was multifaceted. They came back at him and said, by what authority did you do that? In other words, who gave you the right to drive out these people out of the temple? And then Jesus said, well, I'm going to ask you a question. You answer my question, then I'll answer yours. The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men? Answer me. And they said, time out. And they said they got over in a huddle. They huddled and said, well, if we say it's from God, he's going to say, well, why didn't you do it? But if we say it's from men, they're going to stone us because they hold John as a prophet. Like, well, what are we going to tell him? Well, I don't know. Well, just tell him you don't know. So one of them said, well, we don't know where it came from. And Jesus said, and I'm not going to tell you by what authority I do what I'm doing. But he did tell them a story. He said, the kingdom of heaven is like a man that planted a vineyard. And he put a wall around it, he dug a pit in it, and he built a tower, and he let it out to farmers, and then he went on a far journey. And then he said he sent back, at the end of the year, he sent back his servant to get some of the proceeds from the vineyard. But they took the servant and they beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent back other servants, and they did the same thing. Some of them they killed, some of them they beat, but they simply sent them and treated them shamefully and sent them away. And then it said, Jesus said, but the king had one last one, his son. And he said, I'll send my son. They'll reverence him. But it said they saw the son coming, and they said, this is the heir. This is the heir. What? There he comes. Let's kill him and take the vineyard as our inheritance. And it said they took him and cast him outside the vineyard, stoned him, killed him. And then Jesus put this question to these very economic-minded Jewish people. He said, tell me, what will the owner of this vineyard do to those people? And one of the accounts says that they answered him and signed their own death warrant and said, why, they'll come, he'll come and destroy those murderers and burn their city. And Jesus said, in effect, bingo. That's exactly what's going to happen. He's going to come. Mark says that he said he'll come and take it away from them and he will give it to others. The them was the Jewish people who were the vineyard. God had taken them out of Egypt, had planted them in the land of Canaan, had nurtured them, had fed them, had watered them, had fertilized them. And then he wanted some return from his investment. And he sent Isaiah and he sent Jeremiah and he sent Ezekiel. He sent the prophets. They stoned some of them. They killed others. Everyone that God had sent to them to get some return on his investment, they despised them and they killed them. And then finally, and you find Jesus here picturing his own involvement in history, his entrance into the stage of history, whenever it says he sent his own son. Surely they'll reverence him. But they took him and killed him. My goodness. What was at work here? Let's close with just, what was at work? Jesus lamented, later he lamented, he said, oh Jerusalem, listen to the sadness. He said, oh, Jerusalem, if you'd only known. As he approached the city, he said, oh, if you'd only known. He said, if you'd only known today. It's not too late. If you'd only known today the things that make for peace. But now they're hid from your eyes.
They're hid from your eyes. They were blind as a bat. They couldn't see. If you'd only known today the things that make for peace. But you know what they did to him? After all the begging, not begging, but after all the teaching, after all the admonishing, after all the encouraging, after all the pleas, and he said, I would have gathered your children together. Oh, he said, how many times have I wanted to gather your children together like a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you would have no part of it. And that wasn't just in the 3 years that he was a minister among the people. He was talking about the 14 centuries that had preceded God's dealing, or the 2,000 years that had preceded it, if you went back to Abraham. How many times during that 2,000 years, he said, I wanted to gather you together like a hen gathers her brood, but you wouldn't have any part of it. They thumbed their nose at Jesus, and they rushed his headlong into a series of holocausts. And there wasn't just one holocaust. The first holocaust was in AD 70 when the Romans came under Titus the general and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Destroyed it, wiped it virtually off the face of the map. One stone was not left on another. In that holocaust there in AD 70, over 1 million people died inside the walls. They had no graves inside the walls. You think about piling up 1 million dead bodies inside the walls of that city of Jerusalem, and the stench and the disease. Jesus said there's never been a day like it, nor will there ever be another one like it. They got to where they even ate their little babies. They killed them and ate them. They became cannibals. Don't read it if you have a squeamish stomach. Don't read the account of Josephus. Don't read the other accounts. AD 70. AD 73, when Masada fell, about 1,000 people escaped as patriots from the city of Jerusalem in AD 70 under Titus. They went out and occupied the great palace of Herod the king out on Masada, the mountain. And they had their water supply and food. They occupied that for 3 more years till finally the Romans built a ramp all the way up to that city, up to Masada. They drove their big machines that were destructive war machines. They tore down the walls. They broke through the doors. They broke through the second wall barrier. They thought when they got in there, they would have this massive battle with these thousands of people, with this 1,000 people in there. History says it. Josephus says they broke through the final wall. And there was nothing but absolute, total silence, as though you were in a tomb. And that's precisely what they were in. 964 Jewish rebels had made a pact with themselves that before they would let the Roman army take them, they would commit mass suicide. And that's what they did. They had it regulated to where one man was responsible for this group, one man was responsible. They had it delegated to where each one would kill 10 or so, and then there were 10 or more, they would kill them, and then finally, they would finally take their own life. And that's the way they executed it. Only one woman and 2 of her children who hid under a bed escaped. That was in AD 73. In AD 125, the Bar Kokhba rebellion, where the Roman army, the Roman emperor finally said, that's it. It's over. We're not dealing with you hard-headed people anymore. You're finished. You're out of here. And he drove the entire Jewish nation out of the land that we now call Palestine. It wasn't called Palestine then. Rome drove the Jewish people out and named it Palestia, in honor of the Jews' hated enemy, the Philistines. And we know it today as Palestine because the Roman people named it Philistine or Palestine, just simply to add insult to injury, because these Jewish people were so eaten up with this rot that was eating up the, and still eats up the face of humanity. And the Holocaust that took place in AD, or in 1930 and 1940, that wasn't the first Holocaust. It may not be the last. German people were wrong, but let me say this out of all respect. The Jewish people started this kind of hatred. They started this kind of animosity hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before Hitler ever came on the scene. I despise everything about Adolf Hitler. I despise everything that he stood for, everything that he did. And my heart hurts for the 6 million Jewish people who died at that murderer's hand. I hate it all. But let me tell you, Jesus of Nazareth lost his life standing up in the face of that very kind of racial prejudice 2,000 years earlier.
two things Jesus confronted. He confronted religious pride and racial prejudice. And those two cancers sitting upon the face of humanity still are a blight upon the human race to this very day. We cannot seem to get over it. Religious pride and racial prejudice. And Jesus stood up in the face of both of them, and they killed him for it.